Add a berry blast off for your day with the new Berry Pebbles. A berry twist on a classic breakfast. Perfect for giving those growing minds a blast of creativity. With the new Berry Way to Pebbles. Yabba dabba do you with Berry Pebbles. Head to postpebblescereal.com to learn more. Yabba dabba do and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There is an epic quality to the events in Europe right now. The continent is in a defensive crouch as countries in the Middle East and North Africa, its old colonial real estate, let's remember, collapse and throw off waves of refugees. Europe's zone of open borders, the Schengen zone, shrinking. The great European dream of one big borderless democratic union may be shrinking with it. This hour on Point, borders closing and huge questions over the future of Europe. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is the European dream collapsing? And what if it does? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Brussels is Ryan Heath, senior EU correspondent, associate editor for Politico Europe. Ryan, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
There has been a lot of talk this week in Europe and in recent weeks, but just this week, about what to do. You've got, Germany, Sweden, Austria, and more, France, imposing some border controls already. Can you describe where these open borders have begun to close?
That's exactly right. And it's not only that countries have themselves been asking or implementing the temporary reinstallation of those borders. Just in the last 24 hours, the European Commission has said that Greece has got 3 months to up its game in how it registers and identifies the new arrivals landing on its islands mostly, and also through its border with Turkey, or else it will, from the other direction, reimpose border controls on Greece so that they really can control the flow of migrants getting from Greece through the Balkans into the rest of Europe.
Ryan, I want to clarify what that would mean. They are talking about now, if they find that Greece is not in control of its borders, of acting on EU rules that would let them essentially put Greece outside the Schengen zone, put a bunch of police between Greece and Macedonia, and draw a new border there.
That's absolutely right. The thing to remember for your listeners is that Greece is physically separated from the rest of the Schengen zone. So there's a number of buffer countries between Greece and those other Central European countries and then on to the Western European older democracies. So if you can isolate Greece, which is what more and more people want to do, including the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, then you do stand a reasonable chance at affecting that flow of migrants. But of course, what you do is really intensify the social pain and dislocation that Greeks have already been struggling with in their economic crisis. So Europe has spent 5 years trying to avoid Greece being thrown out of its currency. And what we may see in the coming weeks is that Greece is sort of ejected from another of the core elements of the EU, which is this Schengen zone.
Now, for years, we are accustomed to just traveling freely through Europe as Americans. Once you're in there, for really everybody who's inside, when Germany and France, Austria and Sweden introduced these temporary border checks, but they're looking to extend them, we should note, for a couple of years. What does that mean? Are all of their internal borders within Europe now subject to papers, please, or just some of them?
Yes. Well, I've just literally returned from Amsterdam in the Netherlands today back to Brussels, where I'm based. And so, unlike in the past, I have to carry my passport with me. It's checked before I get onto the train. A number of the exits and entrances onto even the basic things like a train platform are now closed off so that people are all funneled through like cattle into one particular area. Now, some of that doesn't come out of just refugees. It came out of the terrorist incidents in Paris. But you do have this confluence of events where sort of things are slowing down. They don't grind to a halt, but things aren't as easy and convenient as they used to be. And I've also just come out of a briefing from the main representative of German industry, and he just says that production lines will be grinding to a halt if more of these borders go up. He says up to 95% of the value add that his companies are able to create comes from being able to move goods around Europe freely so that they can have a diversified production system. And if you can't move the goods around, he just says that's going to really be a crunch on those companies, and they're not going to be able to compete anymore. So you're going to see not just social pain, but a lot of very direct economic pain as well if this trend continues.
Lots of talk at the Economic Summit in Davos in the last week and more about the risk here. I'm reading the Financial Times. Mark Mazower writing that there's now critics and supporters of European integration talk in almost apocalyptic terms about the Union, the European Union, and its future. How important are these open borders practically and symbolically when it comes to how Europe understands itself?
I think they're absolutely critical. We heard leader after leader and executive after executive in Davos last week make this point, which is that populist parties are rising in the polls. If you give in on that core principle of the free movement zone and you don't find a way to make people comfortable with that free movement zone, then you really just open the floodgates to a lot of that demagoguery and sort of the unstable governments that might lead from those parties, not just leading in a poll or two, but really carrying away the elections that might be held over the next couple of years. And what you also saw was this undercurrent of private activity that was being pitched around the different forums of Davos, where you saw young people who were essentially saying, we've got new technologies, we've got new financial instruments, we've got a commitment to go and build up networks of one-on-one and local interactions with refugees, because we don't trust governments anymore, we don't trust the big NGOs to fix this problem, and we're not going to let that system blow up in our faces. So I think they're really battling against the clock in that regard. I'm not sure they're going to succeed. But you do now have this groundswell of private activity that is just saying, this is dangerous.
And the real clock being just the seasons. It's winter. That has slowed, not stopped, but slowed the flow of refugees, summer returns, or warmer weather. And expectation is that it could just come running hard and fast again. Ryan Heath with Politico in Brussels, thank you so much for joining us for a minute today.
A pleasure.
That change of seasons and the renewed, bigger tide of refugees very likely to come with it on many people's minds. Speaking in Holland's parliament last week, here's Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte warning the EU time is running out to find a solution.
The current numbers are not sustainable. We are running out of time. We need a sharp reduction in the number of refugees in the coming 6 to 8 weeks.
The current numbers not sustainable. Borders closing. Here's European Council President Donald Tusk in Strasbourg last week with this stark warning.
We have no more than 2 months to get things under control. The statistics over the Christmas period are not encouraging. The March European Council will be the last moment to see if our strategy works. If it doesn't, we will face grave consequences such as the collapse of Schengen,
the open borders, and a pillar of European unity. With us right now from Brussels, Tom Nuttall, Charlemagne columnist for The Economist, covering European politics and migration. Tom, thank you very much for being with us today.
No problem. Good to be with you.
Now, we understand there's still plenty of open borders in Europe, but the whole idea that some would be closed and more may close and they may stay closed longer than 6 months. And you may have this new line of police between Greece and Macedonia. What is leading people to talk in such apocalyptic terms about the implications for Europe, Tom?
Well, the immediate fear is that we will, as you were saying earlier, when the weather starts to improve in the spring, we will see the resumption of migrant flows from Turkey to Greece approach something like the levels of last October. Now, those flows have dwindled significantly since then because of the bad weather. Mm-hmm. The assumption is that absent some sort of change, some sort of policy action, we're going to see those levels again. And everyone agrees that they're not sustainable. So there are different possibilities that may emerge from this, just to sort of disentangle some of this stuff. Schengen, as you've been describing, the system of borderless travel within Europe, we've seen between a number of countries border controls of varying degrees of severity being erected. But there is a separate issue, which you've also mentioned, about the Greece-Macedonia border. Now, that's not a Schengen border. Macedonia is neither in the European Union nor in the Schengen area. But this is a possibility that's being countenanced both here in Brussels with the EU institutions, but also perhaps more importantly in Berlin, the possibility of completely sealing that border. That is the route through which almost all of the refugees who have arrived in Greece have taken on their way up to Germany and other countries, so that they're no longer able to make that journey. That is something that people don't want to do, but that does seem to be the direction that we're moving in, unless we can come up with some sort of way to ensure that those migrant flows don't reach the previous levels.
You quote a senior European official saying the European dream is vanishing. People are looking at desperate measures to try to work this out. Germany has tried to work it out by staunching the flow in Turkey. Europe has tried to do this. Offer, give, you know, here's money, Turkey. Please stop it there, or take people if we send them back. How's that working?
Not very well. I've actually been spending the last few days trying to find anyone in this town, Brussels, who thinks that this deal that was signed with Turkey towards the end of last year has any chance of working, and I'm still looking. It's only the people who have a stake in it, the people who actually negotiated the thing, who think that it will work. As you say, this is a very sort of hard-nosed, not very European deal, which essentially says to Turkey, you can have 3 billion euros, you can have visa-free travel within Europe for your nationals. We will accelerate your bid to join the European Union if you just do something to stop the migrants from coming. Now, so far, the general feeling is that the decline in numbers that we've seen can be attributed solely to the weather conditions, not to anything that Turkey may or may not have done. There is still some optimism among officials in Berlin that they can get the Turks to, as they put it, understand what's in their best interest and do something to stem the flow. But as I say, I don't find any neutral, disinterested observers who think that this deal has a chance of working. And that's why we're starting to look at these slightly darker possibilities, expelling Greece from the Schengen area, sealing the Greece-Macedonia border, and who knows what could happen at some of the other borders in the Balkans as well.
The spigot, the flow likely to be back on as weather warms within just a couple of months here, and the European dream is vanishing. It seems so... is that theatrical? Is that over the top, Tom?
That is certainly the line that you hear from all sorts of officials here. You played some of them a moment ago. Mm-hmm. I think that things might work out slightly differently. The Schengen area probably won't collapse, but it could split. And you could, the really worrying thing is that you could see an east-west split, which is something that we thought we'd all left behind after the Cold War.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe's open borders closing under the weight of the refugee crisis and the European dream itself, the EU vision, in all kinds of trouble right now. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Finland's finance minister, Alex Stubb, telling CNBC here that the refugee crisis has become the main focus of the big annual gathering.
The key issue here is that one of the fundamental freedoms of the European Union is under threat, and that is the free movement of people and the whole Schengen Agreement. On top of that, we've had a euro crisis, which is about free movement of money. So two of the core pillars of European integration are under threat right now, and we're all trying to deal with it.
Take it right down to the community level. Hesse is one of the latest Dutch towns to protest migrants coming into the community. Here, a protester tells Euronews why he's angry.
When they can't get rid of this mess in The Hague, they just dump it in the village here. But we don't want them either, so they can keep them there. But not in our farmer's village, not in my backyard. If they rape my daughter, there won't be 500 cops here to protect her.
Borders closing inside Europe, and maybe police being sent to the Greece-Macedonia border to seal that. Here's Slovenia's Prime Minister Miro Cerar telling Parliament he thinks the EU needs to beef up security on Greece's border with Macedonia, interpreted here by Euronews.
We should introduce a second line of defence on the border between Macedonia and Greece. European countries should form a defence on the border to prevent irregular migration into Europe.
The whole European project said to be kind of in the balance as this struggle over borders and refugees unfolds. You can join the conversation this hour. Does the return of border checkpoints mean the end of the dream? The one big flowing cohesive Europe, the European Union. Is this refugee challenge more than Europe can handle? Tom Nuttall is with us from Brussels, columnist, the Charlemagne columnist for The Economist magazine. He's written very persuasively about this crisis in Europe. With me right now as well in the studio, stand by there, Tom, in Brussels, Vivian Schmidt joins us, Jean Monnet, professor of European integration, founding director of the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University, author of the forthcoming book, due out just about the time the refugee flow may peak again, Europe's Crisis of Legitimacy, out in June. Vivian Schmidt, is this border closing, flirtation, more than a flirtation at this point, a sign that the dream itself may be coming undone?
There's no question that the dream may be coming undone, but I think it's important to recognize that the dream has already been tarnished. We've had, before this crisis, we've had a crisis of economics and an ongoing crisis of politics. And the economics crisis, of course, is all about the Eurozone crisis and the kind of loss of trust and cooperation and consensus making.
Taking our minds back to Greece and the so-called
Grexit.
Pigs and Grexit and
absolutely.
All the money that was lent to Greece and wouldn't come back and should it be in, should it be out?
Absolutely. And so what you got there was a north-south split. The previous speaker talked about an east-west split with
Tom Nuttall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tom Nuttall. With this particular crisis. But we also, and he also mentioned this, but we have to talk about a general crisis of politics in terms of the rise of populism. And this is actually not new. Way back in the 2000s, you saw a major increase in populist parties all focused on immigration. So this is not new, but of course it's reached a much higher level.
And when you say populist parties, you mean nationalist, you mean kind of right-wing nationalist populism.
Extreme right, nationalist, populist parties.
Are
exactly.
Are these the heirs to the old, Nazi party and the Mussolini's crew?
No, there are many different kinds. There are a few of those, but no, it's more mainstream. They may be successor parties like the Front National
in France. Mm-hmm.
In France. But these are also often just flash parties that end up staying. So the People's Party in Denmark that has been active since the early 2000s has essentially pushed Denmark in particular on a course that has been completely anti-immigrant since the early 2000s. So that the latest thing that they've done, which is say that they're going to take, any immigrant with more than $1,450, they're going to make them pay.
Confiscate valuables at the border when they
exactly.
arrive.
Exactly. This is simply a continuation of draconian anti-immigration measures from the very beginning.
And they're very upfront about this. This is to discourage refugees from coming to Denmark. Go somewhere else in Europe.
Exactly. And this is government. And there what's surprising is the Social Democrats are also in favor. Whereas the center-left.
So when the populist parties rise, they may be right-wing, but they move the center of gravity, even the Social Democrats coming that way.
Completely to the right.
I've got a little tape here just from just past Monday. The immigration minister, Inger Stolzberg in Denmark, explaining her country's controversial legislation about confiscating valuables at the border, interpreted here by Euronews.
We also think that it's fair and reasonable that those asylum seekers who do bring enough assets with them should cover the costs of their food and lodging during the asylum process itself.
But you've got Denmark's former Minister of Refugees and Immigrants, this is Bertha Rohn Hornbeck, saying her country's new bill requiring refugees hand over valuables is a reminder of an ugly past.
When you seize a refugee's jewelry, it has a huge symbolic impact. The Prime Minister says there's been a misunderstanding, but there has not. It's all in the bill. It has really led to many thinking about German concentration camps.
Tom Nuttall, if Vivian Schmidt is right, and she clearly is, that you have a rise in populist politics there, hard right politics, moving the center of gravity of even Social Democrats, the more liberal ones, is the rise of these populists inimical to the EU, or can they coexist?
I mean, it's very difficult for a number of reasons. The most obvious is that most of these parties are explicitly Eurosceptic in one degree or another, and there are a lot of variations from one country to another. But there are more indirect ways in which they cause trouble as well. In many European countries, you have voting systems that make it very difficult for single parties to form majority governments. So coalitions are the order of the day, mm-hmm. been like that for generations. If all of a sudden you have a populist party that the other parties don't want to work with springs up and wins, you know, 15-20% of the vote, that can make it much harder to form those coalitions. And so in a lot of countries, you've seen mainstream parties go through agonies over whether they should work with these parties, whether they should go into government with them, whether they should form minority governments that are supported by them, and so on and so forth. And of course, that has a direct impact on the politics of those countries. The previous speaker was pointing out the effects of the Danish People's Party in Denmark. This party has been a major player in Denmark for perhaps 15 years now. So what we saw yesterday, a policy enacted by the centre-right government, of which the People's Party is not a member, should be understood in that context. Now, the refugee crisis plays very, very neatly into the hands of many of these parties, the success of many of which way predates what's been going on in the last year. But it feeds perfectly into their narrative of these governments aren't in control. They're not looking out for the ordinary citizen. It's a sort of an elite, it's an elite project directed against normal citizens. And so I think you're going to see that element of this crisis worsen as well, unless some sort of handle can be got on these refugee flows this year.
And reporting out of Davos that many executives there worry that Angela Merkel herself, leader of Germany, may end up in trouble as a result of this. They've got voting coming there. Britain will vote on its very membership in the EU soon. There's so much to look at. We have callers from across the country who want to pitch in. Kelly's right in our backyard. Kelly in Boston. Thank you for calling, Kelly. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. And I just made a trip just after New Year's to Denmark. And I just wanted to give the insight that Danish people and my family there think that if any people come in, they should be regulated, they should be reviewed, and that it will be a hard, it will be very hard for Europe to consume who is coming in without the proper registration and laws put in place.
So your Danish relatives in Denmark saying, let's tighten up, we have to.
Right away.
Kelly, I appreciate your call. Vivian, is this just more than Europe can handle? I've seen the argument. Here you've got 500 million people and 1 million refugees should be manageable. But on the ground, we heard the protester in the tape and Kelly just back from Denmark saying, Danes don't think so.
Yeah, it's complicated because actually one of the things is people look at the big numbers and say, oh, my God, this is a disaster.
But a million refugees.
A million refugees. But if you actually look at the numbers, how many refugees are actually given asylum? It's a very small number of that.
What happens to those who aren't? Are they sent out or they stay in?
They're sent back.
Are they really?
Somewhere.
Are they
but
really?
The problem is, where do they send them?
Are they really even sent anywhere?
It's not clear. Apparently, Greece has tried to repatriate people to North Africa and to Pakistan, and it's not been possible. So, yeah, there are serious issues there. But I think it's also important to recognize that lots of the countries that are most anti-refugee and anti-immigrant actually have very few immigrants. Mm-hmm. So that Hungary, which is the most rabidly anti-immigrant and has put up barbed wire, etc., has only 1.4 non-EU nationals, or actually foreigners in its...
1.4?
This is the Eurostat.
What is a 0.4 of a...
foreigners.
Very few.
Very few. Okay.
I feel sorry for that 0.4. I never want to be a 0.4. But...
No, 1.4, right. And only 0.6 of those are from outside the EU. So it's i.e. foreign nationals living in their territory.
Right.
And it's only 7% in the EU generally.
Oh, I see, percent. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more room for immigrants than one thinks.
But the people may not think so, or some of them anyway.
No,
you
that's
talk
the
about
issue.
Tom Nuttall in Brussels, you talk about an east-west divide. I mean, we've heard Eastern European leaders talking about wanting to, putting this in religious terms, saying explicitly that they want this to be a Christian zone. What about an east-west divide? What does the beginnings of that look like? What might it look like if it evolves further, Tom?
Yeah, this has been going on for a while now in Europe. It started last year when the European Commission, which is the sort of executive part of the European Union here in Brussels, cooked up a scheme under which they would redistribute asylum seekers who were arriving in Italy and Greece, the two main entry points, around most of the other countries in the EU. And it was all done very sort of schematically. They came up with a formula that took all sorts of things into account that would work out the quotas for each country. Now, it turned out that some countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, Europe hated this idea. They did not want to have what they said was multiculturalism imposed by Brussels diktat on them. Several of them refused. They were outvoted. It was a very poisonous moment in European politics. And that poison is still coursing through the veins. A couple of those countries are now taking the Commission to court over this idea. Now, this could spill over into other areas as well. What I was starting to say before was the danger of, if Schengen really does look like it's in danger of collapsing, then one thing that you may... Schengen is very, very important to Eastern European countries. They really value the freedom to be able to move into countries like Germany without hindrance. It's very useful to their economy.
To work, to find jobs, send money home, all the rest.
All of that, yes. Although, let's be clear, Schengen is distinct from the freedom of movement rules within the EU. There will always be the freedom to move and to work within from one European country to another. Schengen simply means that you can do it without having to show your passport. Mm-hmm. You just wave through. But what may happen if this situation deteriorates and we get to a situation where the only countries who are prepared to take in any refugees at all are in the West, then you may see a move, and this is speculation, but you may see a move towards a split, an East-West split of the Schengen area. And the thing that really worries people about that is that that means that we're recreating divisions that existed during the Cold War before the Berlin Wall came down.
What would it mean, divisions, a split, Tom? A split meaning what?
Essentially two or more distinct Schengen areas. So that you, I mean, the Dutch have floated, for example, this idea of what they call a mini Schengen, which would simply encompass five countries, the three Benelux countries plus Germany and Austria. You could imagine that being a large...
So it's kind of rich Europe sealing itself off from the rest.
Possibly. I mean, these are just ideas that are in the air at the moment. But these are, if you're starting to think apocalyptically, as a lot of people are, that may be one of the points that people are starting to look at.
Well, let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I'm wondering how much the change in border controls is expected to affect tourism, especially in Western Europe.
It's a good question. I mean, if you're an American showing up this summer with your American passport and these new things are happening, Tom, let me come first to you on that. Will it change the way it works?
Not in the short term. I mean, the border controls that we've seen erected so far, for the most part, the ordinary tourist or commuter isn't going to feel them. They're not. I mean, if you travel between Austria and Germany at the moment, it's not like every person passing through who's got to show that is pulled out of their car and has to show their passport and so on. Who knows where we're going to end up? But we're not there yet. What we see from most of the countries that erected these sorts of controls are spot checks, are examinations of certain sort of vehicles on particular sort of roads between Sweden and Denmark, Copenhagen and Malmo. Mm-hmm. There's a bridge that thousands of commuters use every day. Those commuters now have to show their documentation, but people in, as I understand it, people in private vehicles do not. So this is sporadic. It's not like, you know, crossing from the US into Mexico. The fear, of course, is that if things deteriorate far worse, then we could end up in a situation where we do have much more systematic control. For people planning a holiday to Europe, I wouldn't worry about it too much at the moment.
Vivian Schmidt, Germany is the big factor here. Angela Merkel, during last year's enormous influx of refugees, very open-armed toward them rhetorically and on the ground. What motivated that posture from Germany, and is it under threat now that she's got dissent within the political body of Germany and elections coming?
It's actually really interesting because Angela Merkel just... a little bit before then was seen as, well, by the Greeks at least,
the hard-nosed one.
There were depictions of her with Hitler mustache and
yeah, but that one may be a little troops. Different. That was about
that
Greek
was,
finance and all the rest.
That was the Eurozone crisis.
Why did she open her arms so wide and proudly to migrants?
I think this is a question about German identity, and
we're not Nazis anymore. We're enlightened now.
Absolutely. This is about human rights. Mm-hmm. And so whereas the Eurozone crisis hit at one strand of German identity, mm-hmm. Debt is Schuld, is shame.
Yep.
We're not
Keep your
going
books
to
in order.
Exactly mm-hmm. all of that. When it came to refugees, Germany has remade itself. Germany has a sense of human rights, and I think hers was actually a very genuine response, almost intuitive. No, we have to do something. This is Germany. And opening her arms, opening Germany, was very, very popular initially.
Tom, is that holding up, if I may, just a minute before the break here?
I was in Berlin last week. Angela Merkel is under extraordinary pressure. She is one of the most popular leaders Germany has ever had. This is the only time that her position has been seriously threatened, not only by voters in the country, but by her own party. That's why they're so desperate to get these numbers down.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe's open borders closing under the weight of the refugee crisis and what it may mean for the European Union, for the European dream. Vivian Schmidt is with us. She is founding director of the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University. Her forthcoming book, Europe's Crisis of Legitimacy. Look for it this summer. Tom Nuttall is with us, Charlemagne columnist for The Economist magazine, with us today from Brussels. You can join us as well. What do you see coming for Europe? Lots of response from listeners online. Andrew writes, it's an interesting sight, the most liberal place on the planet, becoming less liberal to keep conservative newcomers out. Andrew's characterization of the flows from out of Syria and Afghanistan and elsewhere. Matt says, hey, Europe doesn't have enough babies anyway, so they should take advantage and start a path to citizenship for all the most talented refugees in the country. There are demographic issues of an aging population in Europe. Darian writes, Denmark's going to take people's money and possessions if it's $1,400 or euros or more. What kind of messed up stuff is that? Someone survives ISIS, U.S.-backed rebels, Assad forces, smugglers, and a host of other trials and life-threatening events. Make it to Denmark, and they say, give me whatever you have left. Seems like people never learn from history. And Sam writes to us, European dream, American dream, 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 dream. Reality is cold, hard austerity, and it blows. Well, maybe. It's looking tough right now. Jennifer in Carlisle, Massachusetts. Jennifer, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call in because I actually visited a refugee camp in Calais and Dunkirk in December.
Famous camp, yes.
Yes, and just so I could see for myself, and I just cannot believe that the politics have dehumanized what is actually going on in these camps in one of the richest nations in the world. The way France is treating the refugees is just an abomination, not to mention that there is sex trafficking going on. There are people dying trying to jump into lorries to get over to the UK. Children are living in filth and squalor in tents outside. And the only way these people are getting help are through grassroots organizations. And I just, I can't believe that people can't see human to human on this. There's so much fear of Daesh and ISIS, and they live in these camps. And I say to those people, you go there yourself and you look these people in the eye. And I think he'll change your mind.
Jennifer, I absolutely hear that, and I'm with you, but then you come to so much fear of Daesh and ISIS, and we look at what happened in Paris back in November. It was pretty terrible, and one of those guys had come, we're told, up through Greece.
Yes, I agree, Tom. It is terrible, but I don't think we can live our life in fear. Mm-hmm. I think if we keep these people relegated to these camps, and this generation that's growing up in these camps, you're just feeding into more xenophobia, fear-mongering of anything that's different.
Yeah, Jennifer, I appreciate your witness. Vivian Schmidt, what's right here? What's righteous? What's politically practical?
Very big problems. It's quite clear that the refugees at Calais or the immigrants at Calais want to go on to the UK. And France and the UK have, I think, difficulty working all of this out. The UK doesn't want them. But there's another issue for France. And you've got a socialist government that's actually trying to, is dealing with the politics of a very strong Front National, the National Front party that in the regional elections was up to close to 30%.
A third.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, close to a third. And so it's playing a
If they gain strength, the future does not look brighter for those refugees.
Exactly. So that what you see is, as you said earlier, what you see is the center-right, is center-left has been moving right. In particular, if you think what it's been doing with the Roma. It has been repatriating the Roma. So there's no difference
Roma,
between the center-left
gypsies.
Gypsies. There's no difference between the center-left government's policies and the right before then. Sarkozy was sending them back. And they are technically actually EU citizens.
Yes,
so they are part of Schengen, and yet they continue to do this.
Tom Nuttall,
the Italians have also done this.
Yes. Tom Nuttall, the British looking at those camps in Calais and saying no thank you and moving toward a vote on – are they not a referendum on EU membership itself? How does the refugee crisis, the border crisis, factor into what's coming in the UK, Tom?
Yeah, there is a relationship. It's hard to know because we don't know yet when the British referendum is going to be held. It could be as early as June, but it may not be. They're currently involved in negotiations in Brussels over that. There could be a sort of a toxic relationship because Britain has not, to much degree, been on the receiving end of this refugee crisis, partly for reasons of geography. It's an island, and partly because it's not in the Schengen area. So that means that for a lot of British people, they've sort of been watching this with horror from afar. Now, that could feed into the referendum. If, for example, the referendum is called for the summer and the migrant crisis in Europe erupts again and we get to where we were last year, that could be very bad for the people who want Britain to stay in the EU. Because even though Britain isn't directly affected, the politics of it are extremely awkward. There's a sense of we just want to get as far away from this thing. We want to get off this sinking ship, keep it far away from us. So there could be a very awkward interaction there.
You heard the Home Secretary from the UK, Theresa May, in Amsterdam this week, accusing her counterparts in Europe of doing nothing to stem the crisis that now threatens to tear the EU apart. This is reporting from The Telegraph. What would the UK like to see done?
Well, the UK has an interesting attitude. It tells other European countries that what they ought to do is to resettle large numbers of refugees directly from the region. This basically means Turkey, Jordan and Lebanon. So in other words, don't wait for them to come to Greece or wherever and then relocate them around the EU.
Make those
go
the GNC crossings. We saw more drownings just last night.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Disrupt the smuggling networks. And you can also, that means that you can exert some sort of control on the system and you can pick the most vulnerable people, whereas for the people who are making the crossing to Greece, that there's a tendency for them to be the younger, the stronger, the ones who are able to do it. So the Brits want them to do that.
Would the UK join in taking some of those or not?
Well, this is the thing. Mm-hmm. Britain would not do anything as part of a pan-European thing. What it's already doing is taking people directly itself. The problem for this argument is that the numbers it's taking are very, very small. It's 20,000 people over 5 years. It's paltry. So there does need to be more done on that.
Easy to say when you're not the one who's handling the inflow. Frederica is with us from Chassel, Michigan. Frederica, you're on the air.
Hi. I am the daughter of refugees, of German refugees from the east.
Mm-hmm.
Parts of Prussia became part of Poland.
Yes.
And I am the daughter. My father's a refugee. My whole father's family was German refugees. And my mother witnessed the refugee crisis in Flensburg in northern Germany.
Okay.
And she said she saw entire families together. Actually, she said the whole population of Flensburg, which is a northern town in northern Germany, doubled or tripled overnight in post-war Germany when Germany was defeated and all the infrastructure was gone. And the buildings were bombed out.
Oh, you're going way back to the end of World War II.
Yes.
So what about now, Frederica? What do you think of what's going on now?
I think it's horrible. I think it's sad.
What's horrible? What's sad?
That all the migrants, that people are migrants, and that people feel a need to leave their country. I think that is very sad. But I also, you know, what upsets me is I know from after World War II, families fled together when they, you know, when the Russians were coming in, entire families fled together. I wonder sometimes, I question it when I see that there's a Syrian man or one man in the family, the youngest and the strongest, like one of your commentator, are fleeing to Germany and the rest of the family's being kept behind.
Fair enough, but, I mean, in Germany, they were all on land together here. There's a sea crossing. There's a war still going on, all the rest, and we've seen plenty of children among them. You saw the toddler on the beach that touched everybody's heart last summer. I appreciate your call. One more, Bernd in Harvard, Massachusetts. Bernd, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I want to shift the discussion a little bit. I've been to Germany earlier this month, and I witnessed that there is still a very large part of the community that is welcoming these refugees.
Yes.
And they're taking enormous effort and very beneficial initiatives, private initiatives also, in order to help these refugees. But what I want to emphasize is that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to develop a roadmap how to handle this crisis in terms of refugees that have landed, for example, in Germany. And what I noticed is in different parts of the country, the situation is handled differently, whether people are or how they are registered, whether mm-hmm. they are allowed to move around, or whether they have to stay at their place of registration. And so what I would suggest is, what is necessary is to develop really a solid concept that would, first of all, apply to Germany to help these people, legitimize their status. And on the other hand, integrate them. Because every incident, like the incidents in Cologne, that really have a ripple effect on the mood of the people and their attitude.
Bernd, I really appreciate your call. An urge for some order here. And yes, this New Year's Eve, sort of widespread, large sexual harassment and more that took place in the center of Cologne really got people's hackles up. Germany has a challenge with this. The whole EU has a challenge with this. I mean, Vivian Schmidt, step back here. It's only a six-month closing of these borders at this point, but people are looking to extend that for another 2 years, and who knows what happens if the refugee flows go on, if you have the further rise of the populist nationalist parties in Europe. If Europe stays on this trend, the year from hell, somebody called last year for Europe, and there's so many things buffeting Europe, where does this go? If it's the end of the European dream, what does that mean for Europe and for the wider geopolitics?
I think before we decide it's the end of the European
dream.
We
haven't decided.
No,
we're asking.
I think Europe needs to do a lot more to solidify its external borders. It needs Frontex to come in. It needs to put more money there.
So this is their sort of national their border patrol.
Absolutely.
Coast Guard, kind of, they're
right.
looking at reorganizing
right.
that, strengthening that.
I think it was a member of the commission who said that we need, maybe the president of the commission who said we need a Marshall Plan for the Middle East, so to provide money, economic development for mm-hmm. these countries. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the whole issue of ISIS. Can one end the civil war in Syria? What can one do about Libya to stabilize this? So a lot depends upon what happens in the Middle East and North Africa, not just economically but also militarily. In the future then, if that isn't solved, then we're seeing some serious problems. Schengen will just continue. In the rules,
just
you can
continue actually, to shrink, are you
to
saying?
To shrink.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
the open borders
the
closing.
The two-year suspension may be continued. May end up with kind of different, let's call them Schengen zones or immigration zones, where different – where this
mini ones within
mini
Europe.
Mini ones. Mm-hmm. The Central Eastern European countries with one thing and Germany and continental Europe with another, with different kinds of perhaps work permits for refugees mm-hmm. going across. But it seems to me that the EU needs to develop some imagination about
Tom,
how to do this.
Tom, how do you see the implications if the big European dream – shrinks? What are the implications of that?
Well, People have, EU watchers have often compared it to a bicycle. You need to keep pedaling, otherwise you fall off. So there's been this notion that there's always a new project. There's the construction of the euro, the single currency. There were big enlargements, particularly to Eastern Europe after the end of the Cold War. Always some sort of grand new scheme to keep momentum going. One of the most striking things about the last year is that the place has just been in a defensive crouch. And I mean, the crisis that we're talking about now is probably the most acute, but it's far from the only one. Russia and Ukraine, the Britain referendum we spoke about, Greece and the euro, terrorism, you name it. I mean, this place is really punch drunk. And I think this is quite a sort of, it's a new experience for a lot of people here. It's not one that they enjoy particularly. There is a feeling of if we don't have a destination that we're headed towards, then the thing may just sort of shrivel and go nowhere. And that's a fear that a lot of people have, because that's never been a sort of an animating idea for what the European Union is supposed to be about. So I think that's one of the big fears that's lurking behind this refugee crisis.
What would that mean? Does that mean no Europe really leaning in to help solve North Africa and problems in Syria and beyond? Does that mean a bolder Russia pushing in? What would that mean?
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the people who'll be watching this whole situation and rubbing his hands with glee is Vladimir Putin. It's wonderful for him to see this sort of friction within Europe. And there have been all sorts of suggestions that the Russian states may have been involved in funding or providing other forms of support for some of the populist parties that we were speaking about earlier. It certainly means you'll have a European Union, which only 10 years ago was a very ambitious foreign policy player, creating new institutions and new jobs to help unify European foreign policy. We'd see that process go into reverse. You'd see what some people call a renationalization of foreign policy. In fact, we may be seeing that already, where the big foreign policy decisions revert back to the big member states, your Germanys, your Frances, and your Britons. Who knows? I mean, you're not going to see the collapse of the entire project. It's worth too much for people. There's too much to lose. But that loss, as I was saying, of a sort of an animating vision for the club is something that would be very painful for a lot of people to behold.
Vivian Schmidt, just 20 seconds here. Do you see the stirrings of the bolder way to get engaged with Syria and more, to have a Marshall Plan, to get on top of it?
I think everything is possible. Other than the bicycle metaphor, there's the saying that it takes a crisis for the EU to move forward. Well, there's so many crises going on right now but the EU has to do something. Each member state can't manage on its own. So at some point, they have to engage more productively.
Crises aplenty for Europe right now, the refugee crisis right in the middle of all that. Vivian Schmidt of Boston University. Look for her book, Europe's Crisis of Legitimacy. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Tom Nuttall with The Economist in Brussels. Thank you very much, Tom. You're very generous with your insights. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.